The Life and Legacy of Margaret Chase Smith. Today, Maine is represented in the House and Senate and in the Blaine House by women. But 80 years ago, things were much different. In 1940, Margaret Chase Smith was the first woman elected to Congress from Maine. She then became the first woman in history to be elected to both the U.S. House and Senate, rising to national prominence for her Declaration of Conscience speech, criticizing Senator Joe McCarthy's red-baiting tactics. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we discuss the life and legacy of Margaret Chase Smith. Today's program is part of our series of history programs commemorating Maine's bicentennial. Did you know Margaret Chase Smith? Have you studied her speeches? Do you think history paints an accurate portrait of her? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news.
Learn more at Indeed.com/credit.
Welcome to Maine Calling. I'm your host, Jennifer Rooks. Today, the life and legacy of Margaret Chase Smith, pioneering political leader from Maine whose contributions as a U.S. Senator still resonate. This show is part of Maine Calling's coverage of topics relating to Maine's bicentennial. My guest, Janann Sherman, she was a professor of history at the University of Memphis, is now retired and living in Maine. She wrote the biography, No Place for a Woman, A Life of Senator Margaret Chase Smith. David Richards is the director of the Margaret Chase Smith Library in her hometown of Skowhegan. And Larry Tai is a journalist and best-selling author whose latest book is Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. We invite your questions and comments. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Welcome to all of you. And Janann, let's start by getting a sense of Margaret Chase Smith's formative years before we get to her political career. Skowhegan, Maine, a typical middle-class upbringing. Tell us about that period of her life and whether there were any glimmers of where she was headed.
Well, she grew up in that mill town, and right away she began working. Part of it, I think, was because her family needed the money, but part of it was because she wanted to make something of herself. And so while she was still in high school, she was working at the Five and Dime. She was the night operator at the telephone company. So we begin to see somebody who wants to do something significant. We're not sure what yet, but she's a hard worker, and she's striving. She's ambitious.
And Janann, any sense of why? Is there somebody who instilled that drive in her?
Well, not to go into too much detail, but her family was in kind of rough straits. Her mother worked in a shoe factory and also worked in the Five and Dime to kind of hold things together. Her father was a barber, but he didn't work a lot. He had really severe headaches and so forth. And so here was her mother working really tough manual labor to keep five kids together. And I think Margaret decided right off the bat that she didn't want to end up in that way, that she was going to make a different kind of life for herself.
David, Margaret Chase Smith entered politics because of her husband. Tell us about that time and also reflect on, was that really the only realistic way that a woman would be elected to U.S. Congress at the time?
Well, one of the things I always like to point out is at the time she's graduating from high school in 1916, they take a field trip down to Washington, D.C., and they go to the Capitol and the White House. And to remember that women didn't have the right to vote at that point. And another way that she got involved in politics was through women's groups. She was very actively involved in those, and that was really an outlet that women pursued before they had the right to vote. Her husband, Clyde, gets elected to Congress in 1936, and she goes down to Washington with him. So that's really her formal introduction to elective politics. He passes away in 1940. she then succeeds him. So that's how she first got into Congress, was through her husband. But like I say, she did have these this outlet of women's groups as well, which I think served her very well when she starts running for elective politics.
And am I right in recalling that before he died, her husband encouraged her to run for his seat?
Yes. He had sent out a letter saying that he had was hopeful that his supporters would throw their support behind Margaret.
All right. Larry, bringing you into the conversation, tell us about the early part of Margaret Chase Smith's early part of her political career. She didn't make a big splash right away, did she?
She didn't. And the I think that the thing that she is most remembered for beyond the state of Maine is her taking on Senator Joe McCarthy in the middle of his Red Scare movement at a moment when nobody else in the Senate really had the courage to do it. And it was unlikely that she would be the one to do it because she actually thought McCarthy was a great guy. But as he was launching his crusade against communism, and as it was clear that it was a bit of a fraud and a hoax, she was the first one to stand up and declare it as such. It was her proudest moment in the chamber, but it was also one throughout her career that she would pay dearly.
Mm, yeah, let's spend some time talking about that. We've sort of just leapfrogged through her life, but we talked that Margaret Chase Smith was first elected to Congress after the death of her husband and then became the first woman to be elected to both the U.S. House and Senate. Maybe I'll turn back to you, Janann, at this point. At this point, as a young senator, before the Declaration of Conscience speech, what was Margaret Chase Smith like? What was she known for? What were her issues?
Well, she had been very active during the war, working for women in the military. That was a really a significant issue for her. She was also fairly active, as much as she could be as a freshman in the Senate. The thing about Margaret that I really want to emphasize is that she had a really firm sense of right and wrong. And I think that is why, how she got the courage to take on Joseph McCarthy when everybody else was frightened of him. That was actually her very first speech on the floor of the Senate. And it was, as Larry said, a moment of great pride for her. But she paid dearly for it. McCarthy
right.
had her thrown off committees, attacked her in the newspapers. She was seen as a pariah in her own party. But it remained to the day she died, telling me that it was still the thing that she was most proud of having done.
David, what do we know from her library, from her letters, her correspondence before the Declaration of Conscience speech, what she was thinking, when she decided to make this, who she talked to about it?
She had been urged by some people to do this. She had a very strong chief of staff named Bill Lewis who helped her shape what her comments would be, what her remarks would be. And one of the interesting things is there's not really a lot of written down of what she was thinking. There are these encouragements for her to say something. But what's really interesting is to see all the drafts that the speech went to and how hard they worked on to crafting to get it just the right way. And one of the things that always stands out to me and how things have gotten very different today, she never mentions Joe McCarthy by name in the speech. It's by criticizing the tactics. So she kept it away from a personal attack and just more specifically talked about the types of things that were being done that she disapproved of.
Larry, tell us about that moment. Tell us about, you've written this biography of Joe McCarthy all about that time. Take us back to that time. Help Americans, especially those of us who were not alive then, to understand what it was like to be living during that time, what it was like to be watching these hearings on television and then the speech itself.
Sure. So it was an incredibly scary moment in American history. And I want you to imagine, so this is 1950 that we're talking about. And recently, we have exposed the atomic spies, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. They were tried, they were convicted, they were sentenced to death for passing on our atomic secrets to the Soviets. We had watched nationalist China recently be transformed to red China. And what I'm about to tell you is something that anybody who didn't live through it would have a tough time believing, but we were about to teach our children what they called duck and cover, which was if there was a Soviet explosion of an atomic bomb, all the school children had to do was put their hands over their heads and duck under their desks, and they would be okay. And that was a sign of just how afraid we were of an atomic war and of the Soviet Union. And Joe McCarthy capitalized on that fear by delivering a famous speech in Wheeling, West Virginia, where he held up in his hand a sheaf of papers, and he said, "I have in my hand a list of 205 spies at our very own State Department, and they are a big part of the reason why we are so afraid of the Soviet Union." Well, what he had in his hand might have been his wife's grocery list, and it might have been some recycled document from somewhere, but as Margaret Chase Smith was quick to point out, saying that he had an actual list of 205 spies in the State Department was a fraud and a hoax. And the whole set of tactics that McCarthy used of reckless accusation and of guilt by association, she felt was an affront to basic American values. So she and six fellow moderate Republicans got together, launched this declaration of conscience, and essentially called McCarthy out. And what she got for her troubles was McCarthy, in classic name-calling fashion that may ring a bell today, he dubbed Smith and her six allies Snow White and the Six Dwarfs, and he proceeded to, after having promised that he would support her for a vice presidential nomination, he made clear that any promises he made were off and that he was going to go on the attack, which he did.
What was, Larry, what was the reception in the public to her speech?
So the reception in the public, the reception of her fellow Republicans was generally one of silence, and they didn't want to go out on the limb with Smith and her six brave colleagues. The public seemed to people who felt that McCarthy was as reckless as Smith did, saw her as a champion. Others who were McCarthy defenders took umbrage at what she was doing. And I thought that one of the best responses to what she had done was from a famous statesman and financier named Bernard Baruch, who said that if a man had delivered the same rebuke that Smith did, he would be the next president of the United States.
Janann, that brings up something I really wanted to talk to you about. How did the fact that she was a woman serving in the 1950s in the U.S. Senate, how did that affect her decision? How did that affect the response to her decision? What Larry said about, you know, how she would have been perceived differently if she were a man. What are your thoughts on not just what he just said, but how she conducted herself as a U.S. senator?
Well, one thing I wanted to say in response to what Larry said was about the six colleagues who signed on with her. It was less than 2 weeks before every one of them denied that they really meant what she had said. Or as a newspaper reporter put it, they ran like ants from a burning log. Because McCarthy was terrorizing everybody, including all of his colleagues. His Republican colleagues kind of liked what he was doing because it was putting the Democrats on the defense. But he was a serious threat to whoever came along. I'm not sure whether the gender thing really enters into this. I know that a lot of people found it easy to dismiss her. She was new. She was a freshman. She was a woman. but she was also very forthright and strong about it. So she was dismissed politically, but I think she had quite a lot of cheerleaders, and certainly in the state of Maine, who reelected her in 1954, despite McCarthy sending in his own handpicked candidate to try to destroy her reputation in Maine. She survives it, yes, politically, but as I said, she becomes a pariah for her party. And as a woman, she never was really their favorite to begin with. And I guess that's all I need to say at that point.
All right. I'm going to go to a call at this point. I'm going to go to Nate, who's calling from Owl's Head. Hi, Nate. Go ahead.
Hi. You just you really answered my question with that last point that was made there. But I do have a second question to ask, which is, what is her legacy in terms of Maine's independent political voice in the Congress? It sounds like you mentioned she became a pariah in her party, but she was willing to speak out for her own point of view and represent the state in spite of what her party thought. Do you see that legacy in subsequent senators from our state?
Nate, great question. David, I'm going to turn to you for that.
It is something that Maine senators have been noted for. We had, I think it was almost 20 years ago now, we had a conference here, and we had the historian of the United States Senate speak. He talked about that is a thread that has gone through Maine senatorial delegations through the years, that they've quite often known for their independence and that they've often been willing to stand up to their party.
So can I jump in with something quickly on that?
Sure.
I think that it is, it's a great question, and I think it, you all know the state of Maine better than I do, but I think it's an interesting thing that two senators in particular took on Margaret Chase Smith as a role model. One was Bill Cohen, and the other is Susan Collins. And Susan Collins ended up chairing, ironically, the same powerful subcommittee that McCarthy had chaired in launching his crusade against communism. Susan Collins, years later, chaired and ended up releasing the incredibly interesting and revealing transcripts of all of the closed hearings that McCarthy held that showed just how unhinged he became when he went behind closed doors. Susan Collins, I think a lot of today's election is about whether she is showing the independence or not that Margaret Chase Smith, her role model, did. But I think that I want to also, and I'd love to hear what the others think about this, I don't want to too much lionize Smith for what she did in taking on McCarthy. She showed tremendous courage, and yet once the Korean War broke out, she embraced not just a lot of McCarthy's anti-communism, but some of his unforgiving tactics as well. So, yes, she was courageous. Yes, she stood up to him at a time when very few others were willing to do that of either party in the Senate. But, yes, she also found the pressures of anti-communism, and especially, as I say, after the Korean War, things that she was unable to resist.
Thank you, Nate, for your question. And Larry, thank you for that. We do need to go to a break. I want to pick up on that thread after that. We're talking about the life of Margaret Chase Smith on Maine Calling. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Send an email, a brief email, please, to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Maine Humanities Council, using books and big ideas to foster meaningful connection in communities statewide. Learn more at mainehumanities.org. By Bull Moose, celebrating the tactile experience of reading and proponents of dog ears and bookmarks. Locations across Maine and at bullmoose.com. And New England Cancer Specialists, proud to be a member of the Dana-Farber Cancer Care Collaborative. Learn more at newenglandcancerspecialists.com.
American voters will finally get to choose who they want in the White House.
I'm running as a proud Democrat, but I will govern as an American president.
Get out and vote. The red wave is coming.
And an anxious nation awaits the results of critical contests around the country. Join us Tuesday night for NPR's special live coverage of Election Night 2020 from NPR News.
Coverage starts tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock and is expected to last into the overnight. Tomorrow is finally Election Day. Our three main public news Your Vote 2020 debates for Senate and the two congressional districts are available anytime at mainepublic.org. Both Maine Public Radio and television will rebroadcast the Senate debate today on radio. It can be heard at 2 o'clock this afternoon, and on television it can be seen at 8 this evening. And again, all of the debates are available at mainepublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we are talking about Margaret Chase Smith, her influence in Maine and her achievements as the first female politician to be elected to both the U.S. House and Senate. My guests are David Richards, director of the Margaret Chase Smith Library in Skowhegan, Larry Tye, journalist and New York Times best-selling author. His most recent book is about Senator Joe McCarthy. And Janann Sherman, who is a retired professor of history and author of the Margaret Chase Smith biography, No Place for a Woman. Share your comments or questions. Email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Want to follow up on what Larry was talking about before the break. And Janann, I'll go to you first. Who Margaret Chase Smith was after this speech, ardent anti-communist, and indeed adopting some of the tactics of McCarthy, Larry says.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with the last part, but I will say that looking at her rhetoric and looking at her career at post that speech, she is the subject of a great deal of attacks. She is called upon to prove her bona fides, her anti-communist bona fides. I mean, nobody could be in favor of that, of being anti-communism. And so she becomes certainly, as the Korean War and later in the Vietnam War, she becomes more hawkish, more zealous than she was to begin with. I think that she was under tremendous pressure to be taken seriously. And as I said, the attacks for her, because they were interpreted as not just attacks against McCarthy, but against the whole idea of anti-communism. And so she does bend over backwards to prove that that's just not so.
David.
Yes. okay. I would not say that she adopted the tactics of Joe McCarthy, but she, as Professor Sherman pointed out, she did become a very ardent anti-communist and very hawkish in foreign policy. But on the other hand, after the war, one of the things that she does is she goes out and I think it was 1948, she does a tour of Europe. She becomes a very strong supporter of the Marshall Plan. She takes another world trip in 1954 and 55, where she visits 23 countries around the world. And she's going out there. It's just not that she's a blind anti-communist. She's trying to understand why communism is taking root in Western Europe. Why are communists getting elected in places like France and Italy into their parliaments? So it wasn't just a reactionary stance against communism. She was really trying to go out into the world and understand what was going on.
We'll go to Kathy, who's calling from Orono. Hi, Kathy. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm enjoying this. My first political memory is McCarthy on our first family television and my mother being so disturbed by him. And it turns out Margaret Chase Smith became my mother's political hero. She was on the Republican Town Committee of Brunswick and very active. But on a personal level, I think what's missing now is what Margaret Chase Smith had, which was a direct connection with the people of Maine. She was accessible. She helped wherever she could. She became very active with the Brunswick Junior High School Band Parents Group. She helped us raise money to represent Maine in Kennedy's inaugural parade. She came to our spaghetti suppers And, of course, it drew more people to attend. And later on, when we had a French exchange student in my family, we wrote and asked. She got us tickets to the Senate Gallery. She had a tour. We visited her in her office. And I'm sure many, many other Mainers had similar experiences. And I miss that a lot. She was a moderate, yes, anti-communism in that time frame. I was one of the children who was taught to duck and cover. I lived in a Navy town with planes flying overhead, for instance, all during the Cuban Missile Crisis. So I think she was, that was common for her time, was to be very afraid of communist influence. And we found out later it moderated and it wasn't something we had to be quite so terrified of. But that's what the media told us at the time. So I miss her, and I'm hoping for a return to that kind of connection with Mainers in Washington. Thanks.
Kathy, yeah, thank you so much for your call. And David, I think that especially now in 2020, this is the story. This is the Margaret Chase Smith people remember, the post her career, her political career, but the person she was when she came back to Maine and lived in Skowhegan again.
Well, to follow up on what the caller just said, it was during her time in the Senate. She was very known for constituent service. Elections were very different in her day. It was about going out and meeting people. It wasn't about raising tens of millions of dollars to do television ads. She would send back campaign donations. She would only take money from the Republican Senate reelection committee and ran her campaigns on shoestrings, and it was all about going out and meeting people. And when she was elected, to be very attentive to the needs of her constituents, what's referred to as constituent service. And time again, we hear stories from people about that very direct personal connection they had with Margaret Chase Smith, and that's what served her very well until her final election in 1972.
Well, and it's ironic, isn't it, Janann? And I'll turn to this because I was able to find a 1972 debate between Margaret Chase Smith and Bill Hathaway. And my understanding is that during that time, she was being criticized for not having a strong enough connection to Maine anymore.
Let me go back to the early career to sort of set that story up. She was extraordinarily accessible to people in Maine for most of the time once she was in the Senate. She would get in the car on Friday night after the last vote, and her assistant usually was driving. They would eat pimento cheese sandwiches to sustain them to get home so that they could be home for a breakfast with a group in Portland, a lunch with somebody in Waldorboro. She would set up meetings in post offices and Grange halls all over the state. It was very much what they used to call retail politics, face-to-face, get to know people. I remember finding in the Margaret Chase Smith Library, there's some raw footage on VHS tapes showing her in greeting lines, in reception lines. And everybody would come through to shake her hand. She remembered something about them, the name of their kids, whether they had a boy in service. She was very focused on individuals in Maine, and that's what made her so popular and got her reelected so well. And, of course, David talked about her responsiveness to her constituents was just extraordinary. She had a full staff who had to answer the letter that arrived the day it arrived and have an answer for anybody who missed a Social Security check or hadn't heard from their son in the Navy. That sort of thing made her very popular. What happens toward the end, though, in 1972, first of all, she's getting older. She'd had three hip replacements, and so there was a sense that she was getting kind of crippled. Her assistant, Bill Lewis, who was everything to her, he was sick. He was having heart trouble. And so she came home less often. There was also, these stories are always more complicated than I want to get into, but there is also the issue of the Vietnam War, while Maine was shifting away from support for the war, she remained steadfast. She was on the Armed Services Committee. And when she came home, there was some really ugly confrontations with student groups and others about the war. So there's a whole bunch of things going on why she lost that last election.
Kathy, thank you so much for your call. And I'm going to go to Jamie, who's calling from Westbrook. Hi, Jamie. Go ahead.
Hi. My question actually is kind of following up on what you were just talking about. I heard a story that Margaret Chase Smith came to Colby in the 60s to speak with anti-war protesters. And that she had a interaction with Brownie Carson, state senator. I was wondering if the speakers had could speak about that story. Thanks.
Janann, it sounds like you know that story.
Well, it was a rather unpleasant experience, and I'm getting old myself, so I'm not sure I can remember all the details. But it blew up, and she ended up walking out, basically being forced to leave. She was asked some pointed questions, and she turned to her assistant, Bill Lewis, for answers, which really fired up the crowd and made them so angry that she was making important policy that affected their lives, but she couldn't remember the answers to specific questions. It was an ugly time, to the point where when she left office in 72 and tried to donate her papers to the University of Maine, they rejected them. So it wasn't pretty.
Jamie, thank you for that.
And remembers more.
David, go ahead.
It was Larry who was trying to say something.
Oh, I'm sorry. Larry, go ahead.
So all I wanted to say was that that to go back to Margaret Chase Smith and her moment of heroism, I think in today's world and with today's demagogues, I would love to think that somebody could stand up and say something as profound as what Margaret Chase Smith did in her declaration. And I'd love to just read one line of that, if I could, because I think it's a message of today. She said, "Those of us who shout the loudest about Americanism in making character assassinations are all too frequently those who, by our own words and acts, ignore some of the basic principles of Americanism, which are the right to criticize, the right to hold unpopular beliefs, the right to protest, and the right of independent thought." And I've been waiting, in the course of my researching my book, I have been waiting for somebody, Republican or Democrat, and especially Republican, to stand up in the U.S. Senate and to say something that courageous against a bully of their own party. And I've been waiting without hearing anybody do it. And I think Margaret Chase Smith, for anything critical I would ever say about her, that moment of courage is something that should be an inspiration to leaders of today and of all times.
I have a tweet that, to your point, Margaret Chase Smith knew how to stand up to a bully. The person who sent the tweet said, Janann?
Well, I was just going to say, I thank Larry very much for reading from that, because it was more than a speech against McCarthy's tactics. It was a speech about what America should be, and speaking truth to the strategies that were being used to destroy enemies and so forth, are the very things that we're witnessing today. And yes, I wish we could find another Margaret Chase Smith. I'm sure she is totally appalled by what has happened to her party.
David, before we go to a break, any thoughts on the present time and Margaret Chase Smith, what she may have done?
Well, we get asked a lot, what would Margaret think? And what I always do is refer people back to the Declaration of Conscience, because she tells you right there what she would think. And I would just pick up on something that Nan said earlier. This is a speech about what's right and what's wrong. She had a very strong sense of conscience. The speech is called the Declaration of Conscience. It may have been courageous, it may have been heroic, but ultimately it was a speech about conscience, about right and wrong.
All right. Well, we are going to take another quick break. We are talking about Margaret Chase Smith and her legacy on Maine Calling, part of our series of programs to commemorate Maine's bicentennial. We'd love to have you join the conversation. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You have time for a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post on our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Encore Renewable Energy, committed to fueling Maine's economic recovery with solar energy for businesses and institutions. Encore.eco. By Androscoggin Home Health Care and Hospice, providing compassionate home health, hospice, and care management. For health, for life, androscoggin.org. And the ACLU of Maine Foundation, sponsoring a voter protection hotline for help with questions or concerns about voting. 207-204-VOTE.
On November 2, 1942, an amphibious PBY-5A aircraft foundered in rough weather in the waters surrounding what is now the Mingan Archipelago National Park Reserve in the eastern Gulf of St. Lawrence. The plane was based at Presque Isle and serviced an airfield in the village of Long Point in Mingan, Quebec. Four of the crew escaped the flooding plane and were rescued by local fishermen rowing out from shore in open boats in rough seas. Five others perished, trapped inside. In 1941 and 1942, the U.S. had constructed a series of airfields in eastern Canada to ferry aircraft to Allied forces in northern Europe as part of the so-called Crimson Route.
On This Day in Maine's History was created in partnership with the Maine Historical Society and made possible through the generous support of Thomaston Place Auction Galleries and the Maine Maritime Museum. Happy birthday, Maine!
I'm Tanya Mosley.
We're going to have a great red wave, people that want to go out and vote, vote.
We need a president who's going to bring us together, not pull us apart.
The candidates make their final pitches before Tuesday's election with record early voting amid the COVID-19 pandemic. We'll have the latest next time on Here and Now.
That's coming up shortly after Maine Calling at 12 noon here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on our program, the life and career of Margaret Chase Smith and why she's relevant today. Joining me, Larry Tye, who is the author of several books and a journalist who has covered government, medicine, and the environment. Janann Sherman, retired professor and author of a biography on Margaret Chase Smith. And David Richards, director of the Margaret Chase Smith Library. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page, and we will put information about both of Larry and Janann's books on our website for those of you who want to learn more. We're going to go to Susan calling from Bath. Hi, Susan. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I went to the Colby College anti-war, anti-Vietnam War protest in the spring of 1970. It was about 6 days after the acknowledgement of Cambodian bombing in Cambodia by U.S. forces, and something like 6 days after four Kent State students protesting the war had been shot down by National Guard in Ohio. I will tell you, it was not a raucous protest at all. People were there, students were there as part of a nationwide student moratorium in good faith. I actually, as my little task in the moratorium was to write letters to small Maine newspapers, you know, the Callis Advertiser, the Camden Gazette. And the first line was something like, we are protesting the war out of conscience. Our conscience, having seen thousands and thousands of people die in Vietnam, we had to stop going to classes and focus our energy on protesting the war. An earlier caller spoke about Brownie Carson getting up and saying something. Brownie Carson had been wounded in Laos in February of 1970 during his tour of duty. And an open mic was offered to participants in this very, very large amphitheater at Colby College. So he asked the question about acknowledging that the United States had been in Laos and was extending the Vietnam War operation. And Margaret Chase's assistant told her, you know, that no, that hadn't happened. And in fact, Brownie Carson was there, a living representation of.
So your point that she was given bad information.
Well, she was on a major United States Senate committee that was to be informed. I think it was the Intelligence Committee.
It was the Armed Services Committee.
Yeah, Janance's Armed Services.
I want to say that there was a demagogue of that day, and his name was Richard Nixon. And Margaret Chase Smith stood behind him solidly, unflinchingly. And I think that more than anything, though Nixon was reelected to everyone's astonishment in 1972, Margaret Chase Smith was not. She was not listening to all of these people in Maine that were protesting the Vietnam War. And to this
Susan,
day,
thank you.
Know,
thank you so much
welcome.
For your call. I'm gonna move on because we have so many people calling in. Janann, do you have something you'd like to say in response?
Well, I'd just like to thank her for telling me or telling us what actually transpired there. My memory was not that strong, only that I know Margaret was definitely on the wrong side of history, certainly at that point.
Can
Susan,
I jump
thank,
in and say one
yeah.
quick thing about
quick.
So there's Richard Nixon, when Joe McCarthy kicked Margaret Chase Smith off of his subcommittee as a punishment for her declaration of conscience, he gave
yeah.
that seat to a guy named Richard Nixon.
Richard Nixon, yeah.
The other thing I would interject is that she did not blindly follow Richard Nixon. Yes, on foreign policy, but she rejected two of his Supreme Court nominations.
Susan, thank you. We're going to go to Eric calling from New Hampshire. Hi, Eric. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Dr. Eric Sacknoff calling. I graduated Deering High School in Portland, Maine in 63 and went to college at Tufts and then to Tufts Medical School. And as a third-year medical student, about eight of us were so against the war, we decided we were going to learn everything about Vietnam and try to discuss from our senators and congressmen why we should get out of Vietnam. So we drove for 9 hours quizzing each other about the history and all the details, and I met with Senator Margaret Chase Smith in her office. She was kind enough to meet with me. She was a very pleasant, educated, polite woman. She listened to me for about 2 minutes, maybe three, and thanked me for coming and said, you know, you have a very important job to do, and that's to become a doctor. And I suggest that you go back to school and continue your studies and let us worry about the war. And I was very politely ushered out of it. And I have to say, she did it very eloquently and elegantly, but I made all this trip for 3 minutes. That's my experience. Now, I
sure, but you have a great story for life.
I do. And, you know, people change and people make decisions for lots of different reasons. We all grow up slowly after with life experiences. And it sort of made me realize I'm impotent in this discussion. And I'm certainly not, I was not the kind of guy that would go, you know, walk down the streets and break windows and do all that stuff. That's just not going to happen. So I thought maybe with rational discussion, I could make a difference. That's how naive I was. But it was a great experience, and I learned a little bit about Washington and my colleagues, and we didn't get thrown out of medical school because even the school, everybody was on one side or the other at that time. But it was very interesting, and that was my exposure to Margaret Chase Smith.
Eric, thank you for your story, and Janann, you're laughing.
Well, I was laughing at, she was always so polite, even when she was telling you to get out. She was personally very charming, even when she was very irritated with you. I had several instances of that in all the long months I spent interviewing her. So she did it with class.
Eric, thank you so much for that. We're going to go to South Portland and Donna. Hi, Donna. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Thank you. I had occasion to write a letter to both Senator Muskie and Senator Chase Smith, in around 1970, because I had two brothers who were disabled, and they got great scores on their SATs. They did well at Skank High School in East Millinocket, but they were otherwise qualified to attend the University of Maine, but they were denied admission due to their disability. So I wrote a letter. Hi, come on in. Oh, never mind. Sorry.
Go ahead, Donna.
Sorry.
You wrote a letter?
I got a dismissive letter from Senator Muskie, but I got a personal phone call from Margaret Chase Smith saying, tell me more. So I told her, and she said, what's your brother's home phone number? And I told her, and she said, I want you to call them and tell them they're going to expect a phone call from the chancellor of the University of Maine granting them admission. And if they don't hear from him, you're to call me back. And they were admitted.
David, wow. Does that story surprise you?
No, we hear stories like that all the time.
You
know, the Colby story doesn't surprise me either. I mean, it's people are very complex, and it's hard to assess them in 45 minutes.
Donna, thank you so much for your call and for sharing that today. We'll go to Barbara calling from New Limerick. Hi, Barbara. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you for the program. I grew up in the 50s, and I kept hearing about Roy Cohn, and I wondered if anyone on the panel would have any thoughts. I was reminded of him again when President Trump said, where's my Roy Cohn when I need him? And I thought, gosh, I lost track of him, except that I knew he did pass away from AIDS, and I guess was associated with President Trump or his father. Anyway, any comments you might have, I would appreciate it. Thank you.
Sure. So Roy Cohn was a brilliant and arrogant young lawyer in New York who Joe McCarthy hired when McCarthy took over his powerful subcommittee at the beginning of 1953. He needed a chief of staff. He considered Bobby Kennedy for the job and instead gave Bobby Kennedy the number two job, and his chief of staff was this brilliant lawyer named Roy Cohn, who proceeded to reinforce every bad instinct in Joe McCarthy. He helped him launch his crusade against supposed communists. He helped him, even though Roy Cohn was gay, in launching a gay-bashing crusade. And flash forward from the 1950s, 30 years later, when Fred Trump, President Trump's father, was looking for the perfect guy to tutor a young Donald Trump as he was about to enter the cutthroat world of New York real estate, he brought in the ultimate fixer from New York, Roy Cohn, to be Donald's tutor. So Joe McCarthy's protege becomes Donald Trump's tutor. He passes from McCarthy to Trump the Trump playbook. And it is no coincidence that we see all these parallels between things Donald Trump has done the last 4 years and things that Joe McCarthy did in terms of reckless accusation and guilt by association and smearing from the 1950s.
Barbara, thank you for your call. An email here from Todd. It is so important to remember how fortunate we've been here in Maine to have had representation and U.S. Senators Margaret Chase Smith and William Cohen, who are willing to put country above party. And David, I'd like you to reflect on that, because I know that this is something that Maine is very proud of. Many people in Maine are very proud of. Is it accurate? Is Maine unusual in
the
senators in the 20th century?
Yeah, we posed that question to the historian of the United States Senate, and as I said, he was here about 20 years ago, and you know, we like to think of our Senate delegation as being very special, very powerful, noted for their independence and for their ability to put the national interest at the forefront. And he said, you know, in his honest assessment as he looked at other senatorial delegations across the country, that the Maine Senate delegation from the late 19th century on has been much more powerful than you would ever expect for the size of the state of Maine. So I think it is an accurate statement, as verified by an outside source, Richard Baker, who was the Senate historian for many years.
Janann, you spent hundreds of hours not only watching tapes of Margaret Chase Smith, but also interviewing her. We wrap up the hour, I want to know what you think is the biggest misconception of her, what you want people to know that maybe they don't.
Oh, my goodness. You should have told me ahead of time.
Sorry about that.
Biggest misconception. Well, I think that the way that she lost in 1972 sort of colored a lot of things that came before. I think that she has been recently, especially, been lionized and applauded, because we see what came after her. And she was, as I said, somebody with a very powerful sense of right and wrong. She had all those sort of Maine values that we like to remember, like she was independent, she was plain spoken, she had integrity, she was willing to take on difficult tasks and follow through, not allow other people to discourage her. I mean, those are the things that mm-hmm. I remember, and I hope that Mainers do as well.
Well, thank you so much, all of you. That's Janann Sherman, a retired professor of history, and her biography is No Place for a Woman, A Life of Senator Margaret Chase Smith. David Richards, the director of the Margaret Chase Smith Library in Skowhegan, and Larry Tye, a journalist, his most recent book, Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. Today's sound engineer was Nikki Shields. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.